Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, journalist, and author, Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take a look at another true crime case. This week, we are going to be traveling once again to jolly old England, specifically to the city of Ipswich, to look at a series of crimes that took place there in the mid-2000s. Before we get into this week's case, however, as always, I have show notes. If you would like to become a member of the Coffee Club, just go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com and click on the donate button. Help me pay for my coffee habit. If you are interested in becoming a Patreon member, just go to tinyurl.com/DCPatreon. And sign up. There's some exclusive episodes up there, as well as older episodes that are no longer in the main feed. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for Ian Totten, author, or The Deathcast. You can find me on most social media websites, with the exception of Twitter. I've been banned from there for life, which is a-okay with me. And lastly, there is some new merch out. Recently, I released a series of shirts for the show's logo. That's the red bleeding face logo. If you're interested in getting one of those or the original Deathcast logo, you can find a link in the show's description. Had a couple of people buy them. I got my wife and myself one. They're pretty cool. The quality is decent. Again, you can find that in the description for the show. And lastly, if you enjoy what I do, please consider leaving a 5-star review wherever it is that you get your favorite podcast. They really do help with the show and getting it out to other people. At this point, we've got somewhere around 380 5-star reviews, give or take. And to everyone who has left one, I appreciate it. Alright, now that all of that is out of the way, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. A little background on Ipswich. It is located in the southeast of England, pretty much on the coast in the borough of Suffolk. Just shy of 10 miles from the mouth of the River Irwell and the North Sea. Because it's a port city, the town has a fairly active tourism business. And as with most coastal cities that have active tourism, it has a fairly defined red light district. Ipswich has a fairly large population of just under 140,000 individuals living within it. As we know from cases that we have previously covered, any time that you have a fairly well-defined red light district, you generally have a higher than average crime rate. And according to statistics I was able to find, Ipswich is considered to be the most dangerous of the major towns in Suffolk Borough. To kind of put this into perspective, there are 461 total towns, villages, and city within the borough of Suffolk. And it's estimated that there are 106 crimes per 1,000 people within Ipswich proper. According to crimerate.co.uk, in 2022, violent and sexual offenses were the most commonly reported crimes within Ipswich, with 7,357, which is 15% higher than 2021's figure of 6,389. So it's really somewhat astounding that the crimes we're going to be talking about today were able to be singled out by the local police forces, given the high rate of sexual and murder offenses within the area. These are, of course, the Suffolk Strangler murders, which took place through October and into December of 2006. On October 30th, 2006, 19-year-old Tanya Nicole was last seen around Hanford Road just after 11 p.m. Now, Miss Nicole was known to her family to have a drug problem. However, they were unaware of the fact that their daughter had at some point become involved in Ipswich's burgeoning sex trade. According to her father, he had last seen Tania about a week before her disappearance on October 30th when she came to his home and asked for a drive to her mother's house. Mr. Nicole also stated that it was obvious to him that the drugs were taking a toll on his daughter, although he didn't notice anything else out of the ordinary, other than, you know, that his daughter was heavily involved in the drugs. It's unclear where Tania was living at the time of her murder, though. It's more likely than not that she was living with friends and or a boyfriend slash pimp. In any event, when she did not return home, she was reported as missing. Although, as you can obviously imagine, with a city that has such a high violent crime rate, Tania's disappearance went largely unnoticed by the general population. However, those who worked in the sex trade were aware that she had gone missing, and at least according to some of the reports that I have read, there was a sense of fear that began to work its way through the working girls of Ipswich's red light district. This could be from a number of factors, such as the fact that normally when a prostitute within Ipswich goes missing, they're found pretty quickly to have simply left the area, or their body is found in a fairly quick manner. However, I think it's more likely than not that most of the working girls within Ipswich knew one another or were at least familiar with one another enough so that when one of them goes missing, the others take notice, and, you know, it's a frightening feeling because they're thinking, what happened to this girl? Did she leave the area or did somebody take her away? Am I going to be next? Which is not an uncommon thing for these young women to feel. If you'll recall, when I was covering the Green River killings of Gary Ridgway, fairly quickly there was a sense of fear that pervaded the prostitutes within the Seattle Seatoc area, so much so that many of them began looking out for one another, and also quite a few of them began talking to the police, which is really unheard of in the sex industry. On November 15th of 2006, 25-year-old Jenna Adams disappeared. This disappearance really galvanized the Ipswich Police Department into action, as they already have a 19-year-old girl missing, now they've got a 25-year-old missing, and people are starting to talk, as, at least from what I can gather, this was very unusual to happen, to have two individuals go missing just, you know, 14, 15 days apart like this. And at least according to news reports of both crimes, with the disappearance of Gemma Adams, they really began to suspect that something bad may have happened to Tania Nicole. On December 2nd, the body of Jenna Adams was found naked by a fish warden. Jenna was lying inside of a brook at Thorpe's Hill, which is near Hintlesham. And immediately, this was the biggest news in the area, with the police sending out dive teams to look for further evidence and possibly to look for the body of Tania. They went so far as to cordon off sections of the highway in the general location that Gemma's body had been found, and also took the rather unusual step of sending in helicopters to perform searches from the air. And when I say unusual step, what I mean by that is oftentimes when a body is found, you don't get the police immediately sending out dive teams and helicopters. However, in this case, the police really quickly jumped on the idea that it's very possible that both of these young women were taken by the same individual or individuals. And I think a large reason for that is the crimes of Peter Sutcliffe, who we have covered already here within the crypt, were still fresh in the minds of Great Britain. To further illustrate that, if you go looking into this series of crimes, even going back to when they began finding bodies, almost immediately they start bringing up Peter Sutcliffe as he's really the most notorious serial killer of the 20th century within Great Britain, just because of the sheer scope of his crimes and the difficulty the police had in apprehending him. So I imagine that the Suffolk police did not want a similar situation on their hands. Right after Jenna's body was found, the police began imploring the public for their help, with one detective stating, you know, we need your help to find Jenna's clothing as well as her handbag, and another officer letting the public know of, hey, you need to keep your eyes out for the possibility of Tania's body being out here somewhere. The police further went on to state at this point in time to the prostitutes, and this is coming from the BBC, quote, Mr. Skevington has also warned Ipswich's prostitutes to look out for each other. Our message to prostitutes would to be look out for each other. Let friends know where you're going and who you are with. So even this quickly into it, with two girls missing, they're already drawing comparisons, at least behind closed doors, of Peter Sutcliffe, and they're warning the prostitutes within Ipswich to take precautions, something that unfortunately we do not see here often in the United States when something like this occurs. Police noted a few things with Gemma's death, the first being that they were unable to determine a cause of death, and the second being that it did not appear as though she had been sexually assaulted, or in fact that she had had any sort of sexual activity prior to her death. They were able to determine that her last known sighting was picked up on closed circuit television, where around 1:15 in the morning, she was seen near a BMW garage on the 15th of November. I'm going to take a small divergence here to talk a little bit about the backgrounds of our two missing victims at this point. Both of them had similar backgrounds in that they were both said to have been very popular while growing up, although they also shared a similarity in that they quickly descended into heroin once being exposed to the drug. And to me, that's fairly important as well as tragic, as the one thing I try and do with this show is to show the lives of the victims and not just that of the perpetrator. And unfortunately, with this series of crimes, heroin is a recurring theme. So the day after Gemma's body was found, 24-year-old Annalee Sarah Alderton, who was living in Colchester, Essex, boarded the 353 train from Harwich to Manningtree, and she was seen on CCTV footage getting on to this train and actually on the train. At 6:15, she is known to have gotten off the train at Manningtree, after which she got onto another train and arrived in Ipswich at 6:43. Now, Miss Alberton, like our previous victims, had had a fairly decent upbringing. It's been said that she lived for a period of time on the Isle of Cyprus with her mother and spoke fluent Greek and was a fairly bright and intelligent young woman. However, friends noted that after her family moved back to Cyprus and her father died from lung cancer, Annalee began showing what they termed as troubling behavior, which is more likely than not that they noticed that she began using narcotics. Annalee ended up having at least one child that we know of, a son, and was known to have worked as a prostitute for at least 7 years prior to her disappearance on December 3rd. As with the prior two victims, very quickly, news of her disappearance made the rounds, and the level of anxiety among the prostitutes working within Ipswich went up tenfold. Now there's, you know, open panic and fear that there is definitely an individual stalking them, although at this point no one knows who this individual is. On December 8th, police divers discovered the body of Tanya Nicole in a river near Codpock Mill, not far from where Gemma Adams had been discovered, and police later theorized that their bodies were able to be discovered due to recent heavy rains. As with the murder of Gemma, police were unable to determine a manner of death, although they were quick to point out the fact that Tanya's body was found naked. So with the discovery of these two bodies, the police are pretty much certain that they have a serial offender on their hands, although they really don't have any clues as of yet. However, their investigation was muddied a little bit when 29-year-old Annette Nichols was reported as missing. Like the previous three young women who went missing, Nichols was said to have been a very sweet young woman who had aspirations in life. In this case, Miss Nichols desired to be a beautician. However, at some point she had fallen into heroin usage and had taken to walking the streets. Initially, police believed that she had gone missing around December 4th, although this would later be changed to having gone missing on December 8th. That's the date that Tanya Nicole was found. It almost makes you wonder if the killer was watching the news, and upon the discovery of his first known victim, decided to take another one almost in a taunting fashion. Annette was found lying naked in a wooded area just off of the old Felixstowe Road, which is near Nacton. Her body had been positioned by the killer to resemble Christ in his crucifixion, which is not that uncommon. You often come across victims of sex killings who have been positioned by their murderer, although it's very difficult to know why they were positioned as such. It represents something that only the killer himself knows. But it is a common theme. It's thought that many times when this has been done, it's an attempt to further degrade the victim, as many of these killers see their victims, who are prostitutes primarily, as being subhuman and therefore not worth anything. By that I mean they do take great pleasure in not only taking the life, but also in degrading them further as a human being, posing them almost as an exhibition to take away their last shreds of humanity. We will come back to discussing the Ipswich prostitution murders after a quick coffee break. Is Bigfoot real? What happened to Amelia Earhart? Who are the lizard people? Are demons really trying to infiltrate our schools? These are the mysteries of life, and this is the Mystery of Life podcast. Meet Johnny, the believer, and Joe, the skeptic, co-hosts of the Mystery of Life podcast. Featured in Pod Bible, the UK's premier podcast magazine, the Mystery of Life podcast offers a unique blend of wit, skepticism, and belief, with a touch of humor, that has quickly made it one of the favorite podcasts here in the crypt. Mysteries, ghosts, demons, aliens, true crime, conspiracy theories, the paranormal, witches, folklore, urban legends, cryptozoology, missing aircraft, lost treasures, and maybe a goblin one day. If they love it, they'll talk about it. And you'll love it too. The Mystery of Life podcast. Available directly from the show's website, mysteryoflifepodcast.co.uk, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. The Mystery of Life podcast. Do you believe? All right, we are back, and I have a fresh cup of coffee and a new pack of smokes. We left, we were talking about how killers of this nature who are sex crime oriented really go out of their way to denigrate their victims after death. The taking of life is not the only thing that matters to them. It is important to them to further dehumanize their victims, and oftentimes you'll see them leaving the victims naked in sexually explicit poses or violated in some fashion to show the world that this is not a human being. It is simply an object to be used, abused, and discarded. On December 10th, the body of Anneli Alderton was discovered in a wooded area at Nacton when a motorist passing by saw her naked body lying in the woods. As with the body which had previously been discovered, Anneli was also lying naked and in a crucifix position. Police were able to determine that Anneli had died from asphyxiation and that she had also been 3 months pregnant, although it's unknown whether or not she was aware that she was pregnant. But given the fact that she already had one child, it's a safe bet to assume that she probably did know. According to a BBC article about these crimes, another young woman who worked as a prostitute said of Anneli, "She was a lovely girl, very kind-hearted, and would do anything for anybody. But the wrong crowd introduced her to crack cocaine when she was about 13, and eventually Miss Alderton turned to prostitution. Speaking on all of the crimes, Tom Alderton, who was Anneli's brother, stated they were all little girls and in desperate circumstances. It helps everyone to come to terms with it if they think sex worker, drug addict. But nobody's anything 24 hours a day, and most of the time, in these girls' lives, they were neither things. To me, that is a really fitting epithet for the victims that we know about, because oftentimes, and too often in my opinion, the media and the police focus on what these individuals did in order to get by in life, as opposed to who they were as a human being. And in doing so, they further degrade the victims, which might be a subconscious way for the general public as well as the police officers to deal with the horrors that they're facing, because it's much easier to digest information if in your mind there's a asterisk next to a person's name labeling them as what is seen to be something less than a quote-unquote productive member of society. And to give you an example of that, when you see a celebrity or someone in the news or someone who is just considered to be a, again, quote-unquote productive member of society, when someone like that dies, there's all sorts of tributes made to them and candlelight vigils, and it's all over the news that how could this horrific thing happen to this wonderful person. However, when the victim is someone who kind of lives on the fringes of society, they're very quickly forgotten about. You don't see candlelight vigils 2 or 3 years later, or in the case of the Delphi murders, people going out of their way to show who the victims were while keeping the horrificness of the crimes within the public spotlight. The last crime we're going to discuss furthers my theory that the killer was watching the news and taunting both the police and the public at large by waiting for them to discover a body and then taking another young woman. Because the day that Anneli Alderton's body was discovered, another young woman, a 24-year-old by the name of Paula Clennell, as with the other girls who had gone missing and been discovered murdered, Paula had a very heavy drug addiction. And her sister later went on to state that if she had known her sister's drug problem was as severe as it was, she would have done everything within her power to try and help her. Paula was last seen at 12:20 in the morning on December 10th, wearing a navy blue anorak with a horizontal light blue band across the chest and one sleeve. A little bit more information about Paula. She had been living with her partner for roughly 10 years and had had 3 children, all of whom had eventually been taken into a care and adopted due to her drug addiction. Quick little side note on that kind of thing. I find the fact that a government can come in and take children from a family to be one of the most abhorrent things within our society, because the government is simply telling those parents that even though you gave birth to them, they're not your children, they're ours, they belong to us, and we will decide whether or not we feel you are fit to raise those children. I think that's an absolutely disgusting thing. I think that it needs to be outlawed, and those people who perpetrate it need to be charged with kidnapping, because there is nothing more devastating to an individual than to have someone come in, rip their children from them, tell them that they're not fit in their eyes to raise their children, and then to adopt them away from their parents. And it works both ways. It is also a devastating effect on the children, but nobody wants to talk about that because the government sees all, knows all, and knows what's best for individuals. And again, that's just a little side rant. So fuck the people that do that and believe that doing things like that is their God-given right. The kids weren't yours. They don't belong to the government. No matter what bullshit laws you might write, they belong to those parents and with those parents. If you really want to help them, get the parents' help. On December 11th, the police announced that they are concerned for two other missing young women, that being Paula Clennell, who had gone missing the previous day, and Annette Nichols. And they actually take the unusual step of actually warning prostitutes to stay off the street. And they said this, quote-unquote, for your own safety. They further went on to state that although they haven't been able to officially link the three bodies that were discovered, they believe that there is a correlation between all three of them. Well, privately, the police were pretty certain that all three of the known victims at this point had, in fact, been taken by and murdered by the same individual or individuals. On December 12th, the body of Paula Clennell was found near Levington. As with the other bodies, it was discovered that Clennell was naked and had not been sexually assaulted. However, I could find no information on whether or not her body was left lying in a posed state. Now, it could be that the killer is changing his MO a little bit here in an effort to throw police off the trail. You do see this at times in serial murders where a killer will believe that the police are onto them or fear that they may have made a mistake, so in the disposing of a body, they will change things up by placing them in a different area or not posing them. And in fact, it appeared as though Paula's body was discarded in a rush, which could be an indication that the killer was in the process of posing her when someone drove by or they heard a vehicle nearby and realized that they can't be seen out in the area disposing of this young woman's body. The police, after finding Paula's body, they call in search and rescue units and helicopters, and very quickly they discover another body, that of 29-year-old Annette Nichols. As with some of the other bodies, Nichols had in fact been posed in a cruciform position, and she too had not been sexually assaulted, although she was found naked. After finding these bodies, the police announced that they don't know who they are at the moment, although they fear that they are in fact those of Paula and Nichols. Now, the bodies are left there until 13 December, at which point one of the bodies is removed, and police announced that they do not believe either of the victims were killed where they were found. The police also reveal that after the discovery of the two bodies, they received almost 2,200 phone calls from concerned citizens offering tips, and further stated that this has now become the largest investigation in Ipswich history, with over 30 officers being assigned to these crimes. An interesting side note, on the 13th of December, it was also revealed that Paula Clennell had, in fact, given an interview on the ITV news reports covering these crimes, stating that while she was fearful of the killer who was out there, she quote-unquote needed the money. The next day, on December 14th, the body of Annette Nichols is moved from the crime scene. And police continue to receive tips from the public stating, quote-unquote, there are numerous items that have been handed over by the public that we need to examine, and that they have received more than 5,500 phone calls and well over 1,000 emails. Someone leaks it to the local news that the police are interested in discussing the crimes with the driver of a blue BMW. Although no further information is given about the driver of this particular car. Police also announced that the first body removed from the Levington crime scene was that of Paula Clennell, and that it was apparent that she had died from, quote, compressions to the neck, meaning that she had been strangled. On the 15th of December, the police informed the public that the last body that was discovered is, in fact, that of Annette Nichols. However, they cannot determine a cause of death. And this is kind of amazing to me. The people of Ipswich actually hold a candlelight vigil to these five young women. And the reason that is astonishing to me is you almost never see this type of activity in the case of prostitutes for reasons that I've already gone over. But these crimes affected Ipswich so much so that people came together and held a candlelight vigil in the memory of these young women. The police also release closed-circuit television footage of Anneli Alderton from her various train rides on the date of her disappearance on December 3rd, and they're really pressing the public to come forward and supply them with information. On December 18th, police announced that they have arrested a suspect, a 37-year-old man, on suspicion of murdering all five of these women. The arrest came in Trimley St. Martin, which is near Felixstowe, Suffolk. The police don't release a lot of information about this particular individual. However, it is known that under English law, they can only hold a suspect for 24 hours. They can push to have that extended up to a maximum of 96 hours, which they do with this particular suspect. This allows the police to go in and investigate further, going through the suspect's personal belongings, carrying out search warrants on their home, as well as questioning them. And I imagine that this particular suspect was probably get nabbed because he more likely than not was found to have been frequenting prostitutes. However, on the next day, police carry out another arrest, this on the 19th of December, when they announced that at 5 a.m. that morning, they had arrested a 48-year-old male at his residence in Ipswich. The day after this arrest, the police are able to extend the holding time for this individual to 36 hours. On the following day, the 21st, police announced that the second suspect who was arrested, 48-year-old Stephen Wright, had been charged with all five of the murders, while the first suspect, the 38-year-old, is eventually released with no charges being brought. On December 22nd, Stephen Wright has his first court appearance, at which point he is remanded to custody. And I know I've discussed that term in the past on other shows with crimes taking place in Great Britain, but for those of you who are unfamiliar with the term remanded into custody, it's basically the same thing as being held without bail in the U.S. It means that the prosecution believes they have enough evidence to charge the individual, and because they believe that this individual might pose a flight risk or may commit further crimes while out within the public or even take their own life, the court is granting them the right to hold that individual until their trial starts. So who is our suspect, Stephen Wright? Stephen Gerald James Wright was born on April 24th, 1958 in Erpingham, Norfolk, England, which is about an hour and a half north of Ipswich. He was the second of four children born to military policeman Conrad Wright and his wife Patricia. Wright has an older brother along with two younger sisters. During his youth, the family lived in different areas as his father was in the military and had to travel to different duty stations, such as Malta and Singapore. Now, I haven't been able to find a whole lot of information as to what type of individual Wright was while he was growing up. It's said that he was kind of an average young man with nothing that really stood out about him. However, in 1964, his mother left the family when he was 6 years old, and Wright's father would eventually divorce the woman in 1978. It's been said that Wright's father and mother prior to this had a very contentious and oftentimes violent relationship, although I cannot verify the veracity of those statements. In 1974, when Stephen Wright was 16, he dropped out of school and joined the Merchant Navy, becoming a chef on ferries. After his incarceration, when Wright was placed on remand for the five crimes, information began to leak to the news media concerning his upbringing. Both prior to his mother leaving and after his father had remarried. And the image that's painted is not a pleasant one, at least according to Wright's birth mother, who eventually settled in San Diego, California. She left the marriage in 1964 because of how violent her husband Conrad was, and it was her belief that seeing this violence at such a young age had a profound effect on the young Stephen. Conversely, Stephen's father told the Guardian newspaper that after his first wife left them, Stephen was always searching for a mother figure and was never able to find one. The father also went on to state that the relationship between his new wife, Valerie, and his children from that first marriage was a very contentious one, and that there was constant fights and bickering going on inside of the house. And it's very possible that seeing this violence from his father directed towards his mother, as well as his mother abandoning them when they were so young, led Stephen to foster an internal hatred for women, because really that is what we're talking about at the heart of these crimes. You'll read some reports on it stating that we'll probably never know why Stephen did the things that he did. But if we look at other similar crimes, oftentimes there is a hatred of women that stems from childhood abuse and or abandonment by that mother, along with acts of violence from the father that help foster this idea in their head that women really have no rights or value and simply exist to serve men, and that any actions that men take towards women is acceptable, as again, in these killers' minds, the women have no value, which is one of the reason why killers such as Stephen Wright and Gary Ridgway, they target prostitutes because they see them as being less than other women and therefore expendable in their minds. That is how they justify murdering them and taking out the anger that they have towards women who have been in their life. And Stephen Wright is no exception to this. In a letter he sent to his father while on remand, he stated that he was a quiet individual who had an unhealthy habit of burying his anger deep. And he further went on to state in this letter that the violence he witnessed growing up, which was, according to Stephen, enough to last a lifetime, was the reason he had so much hatred buried deep inside. So he is perfectly fitting this psychological profile that I have been discussing, wherein he hates his mother for abandoning him, and as a result of that hatred, and then further on in his life being spurned by women, decides to take it out on the most vulnerable women that he can encounter, namely being prostitutes. In 1978, Stephen married a woman by the name of Angela O'Donovan in Pembrokeshire, Wales, and they ended up having a son by the name of Michael. And you see this a lot of times with serial killers. They hold a variety of odd jobs throughout the years, really unable to hold down jobs for very long. He worked on the QE2, which is an ocean liner. He also worked as a lorry or truck driver, worked at various bars as a manager, and also worked as a forklift driver. Now, Stephen and his first wife would end up getting divorced in 1987, with his first wife stating that he was rude and needlessly cruel. One interesting thing about his marriage and the subsequent marriages is that Stephen made no attempt to hide the fact that all throughout these marriages he was in fact frequenting prostitutes. In fact, it seems as though his wives all knew this fact and just accepted it as being, you know, who Stephen was and something that they would not be able to change. That further feeds into the idea that Stephen saw women as being little more than objects. He ended up getting married again in 1987 to a 32-year-old by the name of Diane Cassell in Braintree, Essex, although by July of 1988, the two of them had gotten a divorce. Along with these marital problems and inability to maintain a strong, steady relationship with a woman, Stephen Wright also had a pretty heavy gambling addiction. And in fact, he owned a number of pubs throughout the years, and each time he ended up losing them due to the debts that he had racked up from his gambling. He was also said to have been a fairly heavy drinker, which kind of goes hand in hand with individuals of this kind of makeup. It's not a hard and fast rule that all serial killers have addiction problems, but a fair amount of them do have substance abuse issues, and it's thought by some that they use this substance to make them feel like a normal human being and to fit into society, but also to attempt to mask the dark thoughts that are inside of their minds. In 1994, Stephen Wright attempted to commit suicide by carbon monoxide poisoning. And again in 2000, when he attempted to overdose on pills. Obviously, neither of these attempts were successful. He continued to have gambling and debt problems. And eventually, in 2001, he would be arrested for stealing 80 pounds to pay off one of his various gambling debts. Also in 2001, he met a woman by the name of Pamela Wright, who was of no relation, and the two ended up moving in together and moving into a house in Ipswich in 2004. At trial, Stephen Wright admitted to having frequented prostitutes throughout his adult life, starting with when he joined the Merchant Navy at the age of 16. Wright has admitted on the stand that when he would get into a relationship with a woman, initially his frequency of using prostitutes would diminish, as there was a very active sex life between himself and that partner at that period of time. That once that sex life began to dwindle, as anyone who has been in a relationship for a significant period of time can tell you does in fact happen, he would begin to frequent prostitutes yet again on a more frequent basis. So when his current partner Pamela began working night shifts, Stephen went out and began frequenting prostitutes again, so much so that the prostitutes in Ipswich began giving him nicknames such as the Mondio or Essex Man and the Silverback Gorilla. For those curious, the term Essex Man or Mondio Man really just describes a particular type of individual from the area in and around Essex. Typically, they are former members of the Labour Party who drive Fords, which is basically the reason that Wright was given the nickname, as he did in fact drive a Ford. Now, according to Wright's own testimony, in the final 3 months of 2006, he had sex with prostitutes at least a dozen or more times, including on a number of occasions with the victims whose bodies were discovered. Now, unbeknownst to Wright, when he was initially arrested on December 19th and was being questioned by police and they're carrying out all these search warrants, they began looking at his vehicle, which was a Ford Mondeo, hence the Mondeo Man. And in the course of looking at this vehicle, they discovered small flecks of blood in the back seat. And upon closer examination, the blood was determined to have belonged to Paula Clennell, which leads to the idea that the bodies may have been abused in some manner, or the victims may have been abused in some manner prior to their deaths. However, because the police have not given out a lot of information about the victims, we'll really never know, but I suspect that he probably hit these women in an effort to gain control of them prior to murdering them, and that is where the blood came from. Stephen Wright ended up going on trial in 2008, and on February 21st, he was found guilty of all five murders. And in an unusual step, Wright was sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole, or as they call it in Great Britain, a whole life tariff. While he did appeal his convictions, they were upheld in 2009. Currently, he is serving his sentence at the Long Larton Prison in South Lyttelton, Worcestershire, England. Yes, that is where the sauce comes from. Wright is suspected of having participated in other murders, the most notable one being that of Victoria Hall, who was a 17-year-old that ended up being murdered on her way home from a Suffolk nightclub in 1995. Victoria's body was found 5 days later in a ditch in Felixstowe. However, police would release Wright by stating that they were looking into fresh lines of inquiry, leaving open the possibility that Wright was in fact involved in Victoria's murder. That isn't the only crime that there are possible links with, though. A number of prostitutes died in Norwich and Ipswich in the 1990s and 2000s. And the reason that they suspect that Wright may have been involved is he lived in a home in Norwich, which was pretty much dead center of the red light district, much as when he lived in Ipswich, he lived in a home that was right in the middle of the city's red light district. One of the reasons for this is the fact that Wright was so old when he was arrested, and anyone who has studied serial killers in depth knows that it's very rare for them to begin their killings late in life. More often they start when they are fairly young, and that by the time of Wright's eventual arrest, if they have not already been caught, they have either kind of aged out of it, or life circumstances have changed to such that they no longer feel the need to go out and commit their murders. This has happened in numerous cases in the past. The police haven't given any real indication as to whether or not they believe Wright may be involved, but an investigator who was involved in the Norwich killings did state that the crimes Wright was convicted of seemed to be much too practiced for them to have been the first murders for which Wright was convicted. And I have to agree with that assessment. I can't say with certainty that he was involved in any of the murders that took place in Norwich, but it's very improbable that the 2006 crimes were his first. We've talked about the psychology of killers before and how they go through cooling off periods at the beginning of their crime sprees, and eventually they spiral and they start taking victims one after the other, almost with impunity. With Wright's crimes in 2006, they do seem to have that spiraling out of control feel to them, because there's five victims taken in a very short period of time, which you really don't see very often with a serial killer who is just starting out on their criminal career. They usually don't get to that until right before they're caught. So I think it's very probable that Wright did in fact kill others prior to being identified and arrested and subsequently convicted, although we'll probably won't know whether or not he was responsible for any of these murder victims until DNA or some other form of concrete evidence comes out and conclusively prove that Wright did in fact kill these women. Alright, so we are at the end of this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed our coverage of the Ipswich Strangler, Stephen Wright. Again, if you enjoyed this show, please consider leaving a 5-star review wherever it is you find your favorite podcasts. Consider becoming a member of the Coffee Club over at CorpseCreekPublishing.com. Just click on the donate button, and don't forget to check out the new shirts that are available. You can find the link to that in this week's episode description. Until next time, the Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Stay morbid.